Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says they've given you a number and taken away your name. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And that was a good one, Jonathan.
Thank you. Once in a while, I do pick a good one.
Well, you might have guessed, if you're quite perceptive from what Jonathan just said, that today we're going to be talking about passwords.
Yeah, and not the game show password, which is unfortunate because I used to love that.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah,
oh,
me neither.
Wow. You're young.
Is this like from the 1960s?
Yes, it was back when I was merely 60 years old.
Just a lad at... In the year of our Lord, 1842.
All right, so anyway, Joe, now that we've revealed that I am, in fact, a Highlander and I battle to the end of time for the prize, what about passwords did you want to bring up?
Well, I wanted to look at the future of passwords, as we often look at the future of things on this show.
Sure.
Because I think the state of passwords today is unsustainable.
I could not agree with you more.
Now, the way we typically go about our lives today, if we use a lot of online services, if we use online banking, online credit cards, email,
social networking,
video streaming, you might have, 25, 50 passwords. I mean, who knows how many different things you have a password for? Maybe a lot of these things are these kinds of services online where you might only use them once a year or even less often, but you had to create an account with a password in order to do something one time.
Sure.
And so you end up with this huge list of accounts and passwords you've created, and it is so annoying to remember all these things.
Well, and sometimes not just annoying, but impossible once
right.
you get to a certain number and if you are making your passwords sufficiently complex.
Mm-hmm. And different from each other, because that's part of the thing about passwords. You know, we're not supposed to use the same password twice for any of these dozens and dozens of accounts.
Well, you should tell that to the millions of people out there who, well, maybe you're telling them right now. So good job, Lauren. The millions of people out there who do use the same passwords over and over again. And it's worse than that because they're not even necessarily using a strong one.
Right.
Most people are using really, really sad, horrible, weak passwords that are super easy to guess. There's actually a digital security company called Splash Data that releases a list every year of what it claims are the 25 worst passwords of that year. And it's gathered from, quote, files containing millions of stolen passwords posted online during the previous year.
Yeah, that's creepy. That's great. Okay.
So obviously the worst password would be probably like the most popular and easiest to guess
sure.
password, the ones that everybody's using. So I checked out their 2013 list, and coming in at the top of the pack were a few winners like 123456, password, QWERTY.
Mm-hmm.
1234567.
I see what they did there. Yeah.
And the highly clever 111111.
All right.
Also making the top 25 were some, I thought, weirder candidates such as Monkey, Shadow, and Princess.
Okay.
I will refrain from commentary about monkey princesses, but now I gotta change my password.
Oh no. Another one was like, let me in. I like that. This is kind of like magical spell kind of quality
it's
to it.
The thing, or it's just the thing you start screaming at your computer when you just want it to work. Let me in. Also has sort of a kind of survival horror vibe to it, too. There's a lot of different ways of looking at this.
Yeah, I sort of enjoy that.
So the state of password generation, when you leave it up to the user, is really horrible these days.
Yeah.
And this really does manifest in security problems.
Well, and even if you are diligent, maybe several of our listeners out there are really trying very hard to manage really complex passwords that don't fall into these simple traps. And but doing
and
so,
and they're using different passwords for all
each
their
one. Yeah, this gets hard. I mean, it's first of all, a strong password is by definition difficult for you to remember because it's complex.
Right. It's not a single word. Any word that's in the dictionary is classically a very poor password because it's easy for a computer to guess.
Yeah. It's called a brute force attack. That's when you're just essentially, or a dictionary attack. That's a specific type of brute force attack where you just take a database of words, which could be simply a dictionary, and you run that through when you're trying to crack someone's password. And eventually, if you're using a real word, that's going to pop up. Now, a dictionary attack in reality goes well beyond what words you're going to find in the dictionary. It's going to come up with words that appear on these lists, like you were talking about, Joe. Those words, those numbers, whatever those happen to be, the 25 worst ones, you can guarantee that those are going to be in those kind of databases.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you are doing everything right, you're probably having to rely on some other piece of technology to manage all those, because we're just not equipped to remember passwords. Like, a really strong password is going to be at least 8 characters long, probably longer than that. It's going to incorporate upper and lowercase letters. It's going to incorporate numbers. And if the system allows you, it'll probably incorporate some symbols. Not all do. So, in fact, there are strong password generators that only work with letters and numbers because not all systems will accept, you know,
symbols.
Like an at symbol or hashtag or something like that.
Yeah. And there are some pieces of software that help people deal with this.
Sure.
Right? Some people have like browser plugins.
Yeah. Use one, for example, because otherwise I wouldn't be able. I do have a unique password for every single service I use, but only because I have this password manager. If I didn't have that, there's no way I could do this.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But of course, that has limitations also, right? Like, that's on your machine. But what if you need to go use a different machine?
Mine's web-based, so I can actually use it as long as there's a browser to the internet.
As long as you can log in from any browser. You can also use an app on your phone to get around this. But at any rate, it's not a really great solution to the overall problem. It's a good bandage.
Exactly. It is a bandage. It doesn't fix the underlying issue, which is that passwords have these limitations, and we're quickly coming to a point where to make a password that's workable requires so much effort that it defeats the purpose of having a password. No one will want to use the service.
Yeah. Well, I think we should look at one more aspect of the state of passwords today before we look at the future of passwords. There was a CSID survey.
Yeah. That's a data and security company.
Yeah. So, like, the company I mentioned earlier was also a security company.
Sure.
So they have sort of an interest in getting people this information about how bad things are.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting report. I read through it. It's actually a very short report that lists what they found. They surveyed 1,200 U.S. adults, so people 18 and older. They found that 61% of people reuse the same passwords on different sites, which is a huge problem, because if one password is caught, like if hackers are able to find that one password and you're using it for multiple services, they have access to all the services you use that password for.
Whoops.
Yeah, that's a bad scene right there. They also found that the age bracket of 18 to 24-year-olds was the most guilty of doing this at 76%.
Oof. Okay.
Which kind of goes against what you would think. You know, again, we have this perception, or at least maybe I should say I have this perception. I am a member of Generation X, and I remember growing up with computers. And so when I grew up with computers, I became very educated about computers because it was a new thing. It was fascinating, and I really took to it. But my tech savvy is kind of limited to, in a way, what I was experiencing when I was growing up. You know, I still have to learn all this new technology stuff that's coming out that other people who are growing up right now, that's their world.
Mm-hmm.
So I have this perception that people growing up now are more savvy at using technology, and they use it better, and they use it more effectively and more securely than I do. But that doesn't seem to be the case.
I did read a statistic that I think from the same report that the 18 to 24-year-old demographic is more likely to lock their mobile device.
Yeah, that makes sense because it's something that they have with them all the time and they use more frequently than a computer.
Right.
Yeah.
But at any rate,
it's still an issue.
It's still problematic, absolutely. What else did the study find?
They found that 54% of people used five or fewer passwords for all their stuff. Now, they didn't have a follow-up to say how many services these people typically use. If you're using five services and you have five passwords, congratulations, you're doing it right. Mm-hmm. If you use 25 services and you have five passwords, you need to rethink your security approach. But they also found that only 6% had 20 or more passwords out of the folks they surveyed. Now, again, without knowing how many services you're using, you don't know if that 6% is like the actually most secure, but we can kind of draw some general conclusions. 44% of the respondents say they change their passwords once a year or not at all. So, just under half never change their password or only do it once a year. You're supposed to do it more frequently than that. That's another thing that's really irritating about passwords, is that a lot of services recommend you do this regularly. Fun little peek behind the curtain. This morning when I logged in, I had to change my local password on my computer. Mm-hmm. We're mandated to do that.
To princess.
Monkey princess. It's not just princess. It's okay. I'm going to change it before the end of this podcast. Now, 89% of the respondents, despite these findings, 89% of the respondents, to be fair, they weren't aware of what the findings were yet, felt that their behaviors were secure. That's the worst statistic in here.
Right.
Because it means that they think that what they're doing is good enough, and mm-hmm. it clearly is not. But, you know, it's kind of like the surveys. I don't know if you guys have ever looked at the ones about the super taskers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where like the super taskers...
Everybody thinks that they can multitask,
right.
And nobody can.
There's like, it's like 2% of the population, but 99% believe they are in that 2%, mm-hmm. which doesn't work.
It's kind of like that. I can't remember the percentage now, but there's this overwhelming percentage of drivers who believe they are above average drivers.
Right. It's all those other idiots on the road that are the right. problem, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you might wonder, out of these 1,200 people, how many of them had actually experienced any issues with their accounts being compromised, having a security issue. 21% said that they had.
More than one in five.
Yeah. Yeah, more than one in five. And now, granted, security issues can become a problem even if you are doing everything correctly.
Oh, sure.
If something on the back end is compromised, then you don't have any control over that. But we're focusing mainly on the stuff that we as end users would have some sort of control or some sort of interaction in order to unlock our services.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think now we should transition to looking at the future of passwords. What
Sounds
is
good.
This going to look like for the user of the future when you log on to your machine, or maybe you're not using a computer, when you're just trying to get access to some kind of sensitive information or private service?
Sure.
What are you going to do?
Well, we can look at some of the more recent developments, some things that are currently happening, and then kind of build out from there. I think that'll work. And so one of the stories I wanted to mention was a guy named Sam Crowther, an Australian, who came up with a clever app that uses pictures for your passwords. So if you were to sign up for a web service, you'd open up this app, you'd have a collection of pictures there, and you think, a picture of a hamburger, that's going to be my Gmail password from now on. You know, you don't tell people that clearly, but when you press the little hamburger picture, it actually generates a 512 character long password. That's so long that there is not any, you know, foreseeable problem with that getting cracked unless quantum computers come online tomorrow, in which case it's total
it's
different.
It's over for all of
yeah,
us.
It's a different conversation. But at any rate, you know, behind the scenes, what's going on is just a password that's being generated, but it's a password that's so strong that there's no human who would be able to learn it. A very small population of humans, perhaps.
Yes.
I shouldn't underestimate human ability.
No.
But I thought it was a really clever and elegant solution, this idea.
Oh, yeah.
And the pictures are going to always be displayed in a different layout when you open the app. So you're looking for the hamburger picture, but it's not always going to be in the same place. That way, if someone sees you use your phone to access a web service or whatever, and they see, generally speaking, where that person touched the screen, that's not going to be useful information the next time that app is open. So if someone does get hold of your phone, they won't necessarily be able to access those services.
Yeah.
The best part about the story was that the guy is 18 years old. He's a youngin' who came up with this idea. Very clever.
Wow. And to imagine what I was doing at 18 years old.
I was creating very weak passwords at age 18.
Man, I was too.
Actually,
I
to
think
be fair,
my passwords then were Shadow and Monkey.
When I was 18, I didn't even know about the World Wide Web didn't exist when I was 18. and I didn't know much about the internet at all. So I really wasn't making weak passwords.
You
I
hadn't
had to wait
had
a couple
the,
years.
You hadn't had the opportunity to get your identity stolen.
No, that would take a couple more years.
Oh, yeah. The Industrial Revolution still had to happen.
Yeah,
so.
Right. That's right.
Okay, we've got to stop with this, Lauren.
Sorry. Okay.
You guys are so lucky.
You
that
took it too far.
Oh.
You guys are so lucky I left my katana at my desk.
All right. There are, of course, services that let you log in directly through something like Gmail or Facebook. You know, as long as the computer that you're on is signed into one of those services, the system just checks for that login and then signs you in automatically, which is, of course, less secure than entering a separate awesome password for every website that you're on. But I think that that's kind of the direction that a lot of people are thinking of going as we start moving into the future.
Yeah, I'd say on the opposite end going forward, something that's going to be less convenient but more secure is two-factor verification.
Yeah.
Which Gmail does have available if you enable it, and I have it enabled on mine, which is great.
I think
you
can also do it on maybe Facebook or something.
Yes,
sorry,
that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, I have it enabled on that too, which means every time I try to log into my Gmail or Facebook account from a different computer, I also have to make sure I have my phone with me, because two-factor verification is all about sending an extra message on some other medium than what you're going through in order for you to be able to verify you are who you say you are. So if I put in my Gmail password, I try and sign in to any of the other computers here at the office, and I put in my password. I know my password. Everything's cool. I hit enter. That doesn't get me into my account. What it does is Gmail will send me a text message onto my phone, which will have a code in it. And I have to put that code in before Gmail will allow me access to my account. So the thinking here is that you have to have two things, not just something that the person knows, the password, but something that the person owns. Smartphone. Mm-hmm. So it's an idea that is supposed to increase security, because the likelihood of someone having both of those things is lower than having just access to one or the other.
Right. So that does address half the problem, the security concerns, but it doesn't really address the convenience factor.
Right. And that's where Google is starting to play with a few automatic versions of two-step verification. Their employees, for example, use these little USB dongles that when they're plugged into a computer will authenticate the user. They've also been talking about Android phones' ability to unlock themselves when they're in the Bluetooth presence of a device that belongs to the same owner, like, for example, a smartwatch.
Cool.
So, well, wait a minute. So if someone stole both devices...
That would suck.
Okay.
That would suck really hard. However, well, it's really the same thing with two-step verification. Like, if someone has...
If someone has your address or your password and your phone, and your phone is unlocked, then forget it. I mean, this sort of security measures, they have to work on a baseline, belief that the physical machines are at least secure. If you have had a physical machine stolen, then there are a lot of issues here, and it's not, you know, this is just for, we have to make sure that the baseline is what is safe, you know, and then we can start to look into further issues, like if someone takes your phone. A lot of these phones also go into a sleep mode that have to, you know, they require an access code or some other form of verification in order to wake up. So that's the security measure for those devices.
Yeah, it helps. It's not necessarily a perfect system. As of October 2014, though, you can totally buy a USB key of the sort that Google's employees use. And if you pair it up with Google Chrome on your physical computer, you can use it to log into your Google account, which is a pretty nifty little piece of technology, considering it's running for like $18 retail or something.
Yeah,
like
it's
that.
Not bad.
So is that only for Google accounts, though?
Yes.
So I wonder if something like that would ever be possible to log into all your accounts.
I'm sure you could get something like that. I mean, when I was talking about my web-based password manager, you could probably get a physical USB stick type thing that essentially follows the same pattern. But then if you lose that, then you're in trouble. So it's, you know, having a physical thing to lose makes it tricky. It's not the ideal solution. Cause again, if you were to misplace it, like I know my wife has a security dongle that she uses for work. And if that gets misplaced, then it becomes find where the dongle went day.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah.
Okay. Well, obviously having a device on you to unlock all your digital services is convenient as long as you don't lose the device. So what about having a physical object that you can't lose?
Like, say, your eyeball or your hand? Well, I mean, you can lose an eyeball.
Yeah.
But guys, try not to.
Right. So this...
Are you more likely to lose a hand or an eyeball?
Depends. If you're a pirate, it's a 50-50 shot. So, yeah.
What if you're a ninja, though?
If you're a ninja, it's you know, ninja, pretty much it's all or nothing. You know, you don't see a lot of one-armed ninjas running around. Or ninja, I should say, since the plural is the same as the singular. But at any rate...
We're talking about biometrics.
Biometrics, right. And we have systems like this that are already active, right? Like iOS devices. The latest iPhones have, actually, from the iPhone 5S forward, they have a sensor that detects finger presence, and then they scan it to make sure that you are who you say you are so that it unlocks the phone. So if I pick up my wife's iPhone and I put my thumb on that, it won't activate because it knows I'm not my wife. So these are systems that rely on something that is unique to you to act as a verification and authentication. So it could be a fingerprint. It could be something a little more secure than fingerprints because you can lift a fingerprint and you can recreate it using something like latex. But if you are scanning beneath the surface of the skin for things like the layout of blood vessels, which is the way a lot of these verification devices are working now, that's a lot harder to replicate, right? If you don't have access to the person's actual finger.
Of course, there must be something that's preventing this from going all over the place, right? I would imagine systems like this are kind of expensive and difficult and not worth the trouble in a lot of cases.
They're definitely finicky. The technology right now is a little bit on the delicate end and comes back with a lot of false negatives.
Mm. Right. Yeah. It's one of those things where you want something to just work, and this does not always just work.
Yeah.
And also, it's one of those things where, depending on the implementation, it may be very limiting. Like, if it's something like an eye scan, then you're working with a camera that you need to stare into. Not a lot of people really find that particularly enticing. There are some other implementations that are kind of exciting that involve biometrics that aren't, you know, a physical feature. I mean, there's some, like the shape of your ear has been referenced as a potential way of testing, you know, being a way of identifying somebody. But there are others like your heartbeat. And the actual electrical impulses that your heart makes when it's beating, no matter what rate we're talking about, are distinct. And that is very difficult to replicate. So if you are, if you get a device and you map it to the electrical impulses of your heartbeat, you can be fairly certain that that device is going to be, you know, geared to you and you alone. There is, in fact, a device that's in development that does this called the NIMI wristband, N-Y-M-I. And maybe it's NIMI, but at any rate, it's supposed to work this way, and it's supposed to detect the electrical activity of your heart and then map it to whatever. So you could use this not just to activate systems, but also imagine walking up to your house and it unlocks automatically because it knows you're coming because the heartbeat says it's you.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. Also,
that's clever because you would have to be alive as you're approaching.
Exactly. Exactly. So for all of those folks out there who are thinking, I'm just going to be producing a whole lot of pirates, poking out eyes and cutting off hands, doesn't work for this one.
Oh,
yeah. Exactly. You got to have that heart beating.
I mean, everybody who's played Resident Evil 4 understands that you can just take the eyeball and use that for the retinal scanner.
Oh, right. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Somehow I doubt that would work in real life.
Minority Report did a similar thing, right? Where the guy had his surgery to replace an eye so that he could get access to a place.
Yeah, Loki pulled that trick, y'all, in like the Avengers. So let's all forget about that one.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, one thing I think about this though is that with biometrics, you're having to do some analog to digital translation,
mm-hmm.
where you're having to take a system where it's going to scan something about your body. You know, the pattern on your fingerprint or the patterns of the blood vessels under your eyeball or your skin or your heart rate. And in all these cases, it's got to turn that into data that can be used as a password. Are there ways that we could just start with digital data that would basically be the same as biometric? Well, there might be. I want to talk about the password tattoo and the password pill.
Okay. The tattoo thing that we're talking about isn't like a physical tattoo. It's not tattooing a barcode on you. But, it is
a physical. It's not a permanent
tattoo. It's not a permanent tattoo. Yes, that's what I mean. It's one of the tattoo stickers that we've talked about a few times on the show. Yeah. One of the little stretchy circuitry stickers.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, sort of a second skin thing. It's not like my monkey princess tattoo on my right cheek.
Right. So at D11, which was the All Things Digital Conference in May of 2013, the Motorola researcher and former DARPA director, Regina Dugan, gave an interview where she talked about the hassle of passwords and a couple of future authentication methods, namely the two I mentioned here. So one example, of course, was these temporary password tattoos. And this is based on stretchable circuits, which we've talked about on the show before, that you can embed circuitry in these. I mean, I can't think of a better way to explain it. They're temporary tattoos. You stick them on your skin and they stay there.
It's almost like a sticker, but it's thinner.
Yeah. And of course, they can have a little embedded antenna that can communicate with devices nearby. So all you'd really need to have would be in the morning you put on one of these stickers and it has your password verification on it. So you go around and you've got this on your body wherever you're at a device that you need to log into.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one way. But here's another way. You could take a pill in the morning.
Like a chill pill?
No, like a password pill. So Dugan brought up that there's a company called Proteus Digital Health that got FDA clearance to create an edible sensor. And I think the original idea was to use it for medical purposes, but it could also be used for digital authentication. So you take one in the morning, and then you've got access for the rest of the day. Basically, the way it would work is that you swallow tiny pill, and the acids in your stomach activate the electrical component in the pill, so they sort of act as the electrolyte there. And then when the pill gets activated, it starts to give off a coded electrical signal, which she compares to an ECG signal, like an electrocardiogram. And so after you've taken the pill, all you have to do is touch something and your body automatically enters the electrical code.
Wow.
Supposedly it's safe.
I'm wondering what the mechanism is for that activation. That's kind of crazy. I mean,
understand. Well, she compares it to ECG, so it's got to be electrical impulses that are emanating from this pill inside your body.
But when you come in contact with the thing, it activates. That's what's getting me. I guess maybe if it's constantly broadcasting and then everything else is essentially a receiver, once you get within close enough contact, then there's a connection.
If it's RFID based or something
like
that.
Otherwise, I can't imagine it being like turning you into Electro. I mean.
Yeah, no, I'd take a pill for that. Well, sounds great.
I would take a pill to turn into Electro. I just don't think that's what this is. All right, I'm sorry, Joe. Please continue.
Oh, no, she confirmed it's so you turn into Electro.
Okay. All right. Well, never mind. Objection removed.
She did not. But apparently this is safe. She claimed you could take many of them and it wouldn't harm you.
So that way for all the things
you can't
that you need
overdose
passwords for,
on passwords.
Yeah.
You can overdose on passwords, but not on password pills.
Gotcha. Okay.
Of course, the thing that I was wondering about it was, are there going to be situations where if people are taking password pills, are there going to be potential identity thieves like scraping septic tanks and sewage treatment plants to find active pills to exploit?
Yeah, it gives a whole new meaning to the word phishing. Yeah,
I would imagine that these things have to have a limitation on their power source. So,
or some kind of self-destruct. No, that sounds dangerous.
I would just imagine the process of making their way through the digestive tract of a human being, they probably wouldn't be in the best working condition by the time they came out the other end.
Well, fingers crossed.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't know, but I'd have to assume that's part of the design.
Yeah.
If it weren't, that would be a bizarre oversight.
Well, also, I would imagine you could also create...
Who are smart enough to create something like this.
I mean, the other issue with this is that how do you have it work on a regular basis? But assuming that this is not for just a temporary one-time pass, if it is, that's great. I mean, that makes perfect sense for this implementation. But if you're talking about prolonged use, like it's something that you log into every day, then you would have to have access to that same pill every time.
Oh, yeah, that's the idea. You take it every morning.
So there's an actual physical repository of the password that lets you into your system.
Right.
How can
So if somebody gets into your medicine cabinet.
Right. That's the real issue. I'm not so much worried about going through the sewage as I am getting access to the bottle of magic pills that gives you access to all my stuff. That's what I would worry about.
I don't know. It's a good question. Okay.
Maybe as a pair with some other security. I'm not sure. At any rate.
You wouldn't. Hold on. You're saying no to the pill? You wouldn't take the password pill?
I would totally take the password pill. I'm just, you know, if someone needed to let me onto an Air Force base for one day in order to, I don't know, like report about cool stuff that was technologically happening there, then that would be really great.
That's interesting.
But it also sounds like a great way to tweet about ephemera while you should be working.
I was going to say, my personal philosophy is that whenever I visit a military base, I don't automatically swallow something someone hands me.
Okay, now we're getting off topic.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Okay. No. I've got another place I want to go with this.
Okay.
All right.
A lot of people aren't going to be very cool with the idea of taking a pill or even wearing a tattoo. It, you know, I guess to some people it just seems kind of invasive. It seems like something they wouldn't want to do.
Sure.
So I think we should come back and look at the idea of passwords that are based on behavior.
Yeah, I've got one that researchers at Rutgers School of Engineering have been working on lately. It's a system for letting users draw freeform gestures on touch screens in place of creating traditional passwords. They found that study participants have been pretty good at recalling the gestures that they created, and that visual eavesdroppers, if you follow my meaning, like someone like looking over your shoulder trying to collect your password as you put it in, they've been pretty poor at reproducing those gestures accurately enough to trick the system. So it could be a definite step up from either, you know, passcodes or like even connect the dot swipes that are in use for mobile touchscreen devices today. And if touchscreen happens to really invade home computer use, that could be pretty rad.
Yeah, you can see how for an individual, like muscle memory could set in, especially if you enter something a bunch of times and it becomes second nature to do it so easily.
Yeah. You can use any number of fingers and create a gesture on any portion of your screen. It's a pretty cool little system.
I like that. But what about behavior that's even more subtle, such as behavior you don't even realize you're doing?
Sure. As it turns out, the way we type is actually kind of identifiable to us. And in fact, it has been used in actual systems today already.
Yeah. So if you want to look at an old analogy to this, you could look at handwriting analysis.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody has a sort of unique way that they create letters on, on the line. And even though you might not write the same word exactly the same way every time, if you have a large sample of writing,
you can draw at least some, you know, like within a percentage of certainty whether or not it's, you know, something that was written by an unknown person fits in with a known database of writing. Similar to this, except now we're talking about systems, you know, typing specifically, systems where very minute measurements can be taken between the way you type certain phrases, you know, how quickly you transition from letter to letter, how long you hold down particular keys. And it may be that with certain fingers, you hold down certain keys longer than others. And it's not like it's long enough for it to register as multiple entries. So you're not, you know, J-J-J-J-J-J-J-J-J-O-N-A-T-H. Spelling my name.
The traditional spelling.
Right, yeah. So at any rate, you know, there's like 16 J's and then you get the O.
Right.
No,
there wasn't an O in there. At any rate.
Oh, well,
sorry.
So at any rate, you the typing you do is going to be identifiable back to you. And like I said, there are some examples of this. Coursera has, which is an online learning service, has what they call a signature track authentication method, in which students type a particular phrase. So it's a simple phrase. It's not a password. This is something that, you know, maybe multiple students have. It's all about the way you type it, not what the phrase is. So if the phrase is something simple, like the moon is made of cheese, and you type in the moon is made of cheese, and you calibrate this enough times, you type it in enough times where it gets the rhythm that you type and the way that you are typing these letters, then every time you need to authenticate that it's you, because you're turning in a school assignment, so you have to say, hey, this really is me. It's not someone doing work for me. You type in, the moon is made of cheese. It compares it against all the other entries that it's authenticated as being you, and if it fits, everything's golden. And if not, something's wrong.
I would think, though, that it might have an unfortunate effect on grades in astronomy classes.
Well, you know, considering that that was just a random phrase that I came up with in my head and not one that necessarily reflects what the content is in Coursera, I think we're fairly safe. Now, of course, typing is just one behavior that many of us do, especially if you're trying to access online services, you're probably typing in some way. But it's just one behavior that we do that's identifiable back to us.
Right. In reality, everything you do is weird.
Yeah. No, it's true. I am constantly reminded by that whenever I ride public transit. It's
well, just, everything every one of us does is weird.
Yeah, yes. Which makes it even more exciting on MARTA. The walking is another thing that's peculiar to whomever is doing the walking. Like the gait, the way we hold ourselves, you know, our posture, our shoulders. The length of our stride, how quickly we tend to move, how much force we use when we step down. Are you a heavy stepper, or do you have, like, I think of toddlers, they always sound to me like they weigh about 10 times more than they really do because the way they run.
Stomp.
Yeah. So
all tiny Gojiras.
I know, right? Like, I can't tell you how many of my models of Tokyo have been destroyed whenever my young relatives visit.
So you're saying, like, potentially your computer could be like the salesperson at the shoe store who says, walk down to the other end and come back?
Kind of, except in this case, they're not looking to see if your shoes fit. They're just looking to see if you are who you say you are. Have you ever noticed someone walking, like, let's say, I always think of my college days. On college campus, lots of people, right? A lot of people, you know, can't necessarily pick out faces in a crowd, especially if they're facing away from you. But you might recognize someone just by the way they're walking. That's kind of what we're talking about here, systems that would do this. Now, granted, these sort of systems would be useful in some applications, but not others. I don't think every time you want to access your email that you want to set up your computer and then, you know, do a power walk right in front of it. That probably is not going to be your first choice, but it is interesting that we can map these sort of behaviors to your identity.
It might be really good for entry into a building, for example.
Yeah, like as you walk up, it already unlocks because it knows it's you.
Right.
Okay, I think we should each predict what we think is going to be the future of passwords. And I'm going to say, for me personally, what seems the most plausible is a sort of two-step verification that's a combination of the password tattoo, the temporary tattoo, I mean, which is pretty non-invasive and easy, and then also selecting an image.
Okay.
I do like selecting an image. I think that that's a really clever thing for, 'cause it's so... difficult to reproduce. It's not, you know, a string of characters that's short.
Right, but it's also so easy for the user. I mean, it takes half a second. Mm-hmm.
I think we will all be issued a familiar unique to us, which will then grant us access to whatever castle, dungeon, or fortress that we are trying to enter.
Okay,
I played a lot of D&D over the weekend.
Come on,
Jonathan.
So
we're living in D&D, but we also possibly have like a subtle knife Damon kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, we're talking, right. I was kind of thinking of his Dark Materials trilogy, I've got to admit. To be more serious, I think biometrics really are going to be...
No, I want a monkey Damon. That's,
I do too. I can finally get my monkey princess password that's a real monkey princess.
I knew it. I was in here with a couple of Mrs. Coulters.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, I really think biometrics, to be really honest...
I don't trust either of you.
I think biometrics are going to be... really the one that wins out, at least in the short term. I've had computers that have had fingerprint scanners. You know, there are smartphones on the market right now that have them. We're seeing more and more of those devices come up and more of those systems come up. I think that's really going to be, at least for the near future, the solution. In the far future, well, you're talking about, especially in the possibility of an era of quantum computers, you're talking about an era where it's going to be way more of a tricky situation to create a truly secure system, even if people are behaving the way they're supposed to. So then it's harder for me to make a prediction.
DNA sample.
I'm actually,
it's got to scan your genome.
No, I'm actually totally ready. Like I've said this in public on the internet before, like at times of extreme stress with passwords, that if I really did just have a USB stick where I could prick my finger and it would read my DNA, I would sign up for that like today if I never had to remember another password.
Think there'd be like
I'm in for it. That's gold.
I think there'd just be a spit cup, but.
Oh, well, that's even nicer. Yeah, sure. I'll take your version of the horrible totalitarian future.
Yeah, I was thinking cheek swab because that's just funny. Everybody in the office comes in at 9 a.m. swabs.
Well, you know, guys, this has been a fun conversation. And we're about to have another fun conversation in a moment. So I think we're going to have to wrap this up because I don't know how silly we're going to be in the second episode that we record. But, guys, this actually has been a really entertaining and interesting discussion. And we enjoyed looking into it. If you guys have any suggestions for future topics for the podcast, for the video series, you should let us know. Send us an email. That address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Check us out on Google Plus and Facebook and Twitter. Over at Twitter and Google Plus, we're fwthinking. Just search that in Facebook. We'll pop right up. Don't forget to go visit fwthinking.com. If you've never been, go check it out. It's an awesome site. We've got tons of stuff there. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.